The 2011 Templeton Prize was awarded on Wednesday to leading astrophysicist Sir Martin Rees, a former president of Britain's prestigious Royal Society. In announcing the £1 million prize, a statement from the US-based Templeton Foundation said Rees's work over many decades has enlarged the boundaries of understanding about the physical processes that define the cosmos. Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, a member of the House of Lords and of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, author of numerous books and lectures exploring the origins and future of our universe, Rees has focused his work on the implications of the Big Bang, the nature of black holes, and the explosions from galaxy centres known as gamma ray bursters. Raised in the Church of England, Rees says he has no religious beliefs, yet his insights have helped to shape some of the crucial theological and philosophical questions at the heart of our human existence. Keen to find out more about his views on the relationship between faith and science, I caught up with him and began by asking for his reactions when he found out he'd been awarded this prestigious prize.
Well, obviously I was delighted, but I was very surprised because I wasn't really convinced that I would tick the boxes that are needed for eligibility, because I am primarily a scientist who has worked on some of the social implications of science.
You've spent your career really exploring what you call the big questions, haven't you, about the origins and the dimensions of the cosmos and about the role of human life within this.
That's right. My specialist interest is astronomy and cosmology, and for 30 or 40 years, I've been privileged to take part in a very exciting intellectual quest where we've understood far more clearly about the nature of the objects in the universe. But of course, as always, the more you learn, the more new questions come into focus. So we still have mysteries which we are tackling now. And of course, some of these problems are of broad interest beyond science, particularly for philosophy and religion.
What was it, first of all, that attracted you to this kind of exploration of time and space, if you like?
Well, I studied mathematics and physics at university and wanted to seek some context in which I could make use of these skills in a subject that was advancing fast and had broad conceptual horizons. And I was rather lucky, actually, in that I started this subject in the late 1960s when there were exciting developments, the first evidence for the Big Bang, the first evidence for black holes, etc. But what's been even more fortunate is that the pace has not slowed down at all. And if I look at what's happened in the last few years, that's been as exciting as any previous period. In particular, we've not only understood a good deal more about the very early stages of the universe, but we have glimmerings that our universe is vastly larger even than we thought before. And also, in a quite different area of astronomy, we've for the first time got good evidence that many stars are orbited by planets, just as our sun is orbited by the Earth and the other planets we're familiar with. So the night sky is becoming much, much more interesting.
Of course, a lot of this scientific research is pretty incomprehensible to most ordinary people, and yet you believe the questions it raises do and should concern us all. It's not always easy to separate, though, is it, the sort of scary science fiction from real scientific progress? Do you think people are generally more interested and perhaps more educated about these issues than they were when you began your work?
I think they are. It's very important that scientists should emphasize clearly when they are saying something with fair confidence and when they're saying something which is very speculative and uncertain. But I do believe that it's possible to explain the key ideas of science free of technicalities. Obviously, we specialists have to go into the maths and the details, but I think the key ideas can be understood by anyone, and it's part of the pleasure of my role as a professor of astronomy that I feel I can explain what we discover in a manner that's interesting to a wide audience. I think people like to know that there are many other planets orbiting other stars. They like to know that there was a beginning to our expanding universe nearly 14 billion years ago. They like to know what the future holds, etc. And so I feel I'm fortunate, and I do believe that these ideas can be conveyed in non-technical language.
You don't see it as dumbing down at all? There's no risk of making it oversimplified, in a sense?
Well, I don't think so. There are some subjects which are conceptually hard, but I think astronomy is a lot easier to convey than, for instance, subatomic physics, which is very far from what people are used to thinking about. Everyone has gazed up at the stars. Indeed, the night sky is perhaps the feature of our environment which is most common to all humanity, because throughout all the ages, people have looked up at the sky and interpreted it in their own way and wondered about it. And we can answer questions about it that couldn't be answered in the past, and these questions actually deepen the mystery and the wonder and make it more fascinating and complex.
You talked about not ticking all the boxes. Now, you stress that you have no religious beliefs as such, but that you are, quote, a product of the Christian culture and ethics of the Anglican church that you were raised in. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I certainly was brought up in a conventional English background. I went to a school where we all went to chapel, etc. And I've become very influenced by that culture, and I hugely value the aesthetic and musical traditions of the Church of England in which I was brought up, and I am a supporter of the Church of England as an institution. I think we're especially fortunate that the two archbishops, John Centenu and Rowan Williams, people of utterly different cast of mind, are both remarkable individuals who greatly raise the standard of public debate in the UK. So I'm proud to be a supporter, even if not a believer, in this church.
Would you say it was perhaps the scientific research that you were engaged in that led you to reject a faith as such, a religious belief of your own, or not?
Oh, not at all. I think it's clear that among my colleagues there are people who have a variety of beliefs. So I don't really think that there's any incompatibility between science and belief. I mean, obviously, one can't believe in naive creationism if one is a scientist, but there are many cosmologists who are conventional believers. I'm just not among them.
Do you ever come into conflict, though, with church leaders who feel threatened by your work? I mean, you had a highly acclaimed early paper, didn't you, called The Collapse of the Universe, an Eschatological Study, which is a term more often heard in theological circles.
Yes, I'm glad that some of the topics I work on are of philosophical interest, and I think it is important that theologians do take on board what we are learning, not just in my own subject, but obviously in the biology and other subjects, because their view of the world has to embrace what we are learning scientifically. But of course, we know very well that many of the things that humans care about can't be answered just by science.
There are also plenty of scientists, though, who believe that faith in a creator God is simply incompatible with scientific knowledge, or at the very best, that religion should be confined to the private sphere. Do you think it has a place in the public debate today?
Well, I think there are a whole range of issues which are complicated ethically and complicated politically. And I think it's very important that the churches play a constructive role. As I mentioned, the two leaders of the Church of England are, I believe, being very constructive in this regard. I think it's really very important that we try and stimulate a public debate which is less parochial and less short-sighted. And I think perhaps scientists like myself can perhaps help by focusing on the kind of problems which we confront globally and which are going to affect the world in the coming decade, problems of resources, conserving the environment, energy, etc., because politicians tend obviously to focus on the urgent rather than the long-term and important. And I think we scientists perhaps can help, along with religious leaders and others, to ensure that there is a broader perspective and that we don't neglect what the world would be like for our children and grandchildren.
It's true, isn't it, that despite our huge increase in knowledge about what you describe as the fragile pale blue dot of our Earth, and yet we are unable to make really sensible decisions about sharing resources and safeguarding the Earth for future generations. What would be your message in this sense to government leaders as well? You're a member of the House of Lords too, aren't you?
Yes, I am. And I think, indeed, there is a contrast between what science would allow us to do and what is actually happening. I mean, I'm a technical optimist, and I believe that we have or soon will have the capability to provide a good life for all the world's population, and that population will, of course, be higher by 2050 than it is today. But, of course, the gap between what we could do and what we are doing is getting ever more worrying. So although I'm a technical optimist, I'm rather a political pessimist, although I think we must strive hard to ensure that the benefits of globalization are fairly shared and to ensure that the science which we have learned is applied for the benefit of the developing as well as the developed world.
As you say, you believe that although technology is a good thing, our human ability to manage its consequences is very limited, and that there will be some kind of either man-made disaster or deliberate technological terror attack. It's almost inevitable, you think, don't you, within the next few decades?
I think we're going to have a bumpy ride through this century, and I think we'd be very lucky indeed if we avoid some severe setbacks stemming from two things. The first is the growing impact that we are collectively having on the planet, because the more of us, each of us more demanding of energy and resources. And secondly, technology is empowering individuals and small groups. And in our ever more interconnected and networked world, it's easier for a small group to cause disruption. And I think to cope with these two concerns is going to be a challenge to our politicians. But I think by raising awareness of these, one can perhaps help to minimize the risk of these downsides. But of course, the main problem is that we are going to have a growing population, at least until 2050. But I hope very much that after that time, the population will gradually decline, because all the problems facing the world are aggravated by a growing population.
One of the most thought-provoking areas that you work on is whether the universe could in fact be just one of many other similar places. You call it an archipelago of cosmoses, don't you, that could sustain other types of life that are more or less complex than our own. Again, this is a discovery that could profoundly affect religious beliefs as well as the way we view ourselves and our world. Do you think that we will have the answer to this question within a generation or so?
Well, I don't know. I think cosmology is a story of expanding horizons. I mean, centuries ago, people thought the solar system was all there is and the stars were just painted on the vault of heaven, as it were. Then we realized that we were in a galaxy. Then we realized that our galaxy was one of billions visible through a large telescope. And what I suspect is that we may have to enlarge our horizons still more and realize that there's a lot more to physical reality than the huge domain we can observe with our telescopes. There may even be other big bangs apart from our own. And this, of course, does have philosophical implications. In particular, it means that what we think of as the fundamental universal laws of nature may, in this grander perspective, be just, as it were, bylaws in our cosmic patch. And the entire universe may be far larger than what we've traditionally called the universe, and may be governed by a whole range of different laws. And this is something which is fascinating to scientists. It's a challenge, and I'm not sure how likely they are to solve these questions this century, but it certainly is something which has great philosophical implications.
My thanks there to Martin Rees, recipient of the 2011 Templeton Prize.